Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program. I'm joined by my colleague Johanna Mendelson-Forman, senior associate of CSIS, and a person whom you know quite well, our speaker this afternoon, Ambassador William R. Brownfield. Ambassador Brownfield is one of the most distinguished and experimented, to borrow a term from Spanish, diplomats in Latin America, in the United States, has been ambassador to Colombia since 2007. He was ambassador to Venezuela before that assignment, and previous to that, ambassador to Chile. He's a career foreign service officer who has served in a number of important assignments in Washington as well, including Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. Ambassador Brownfield will make his remarks, and then we'll open the floor to questions from all of you. Again, it's a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming. And a special pleasure to introduce Ambassador Bill Brownfield.
My mother always said it was best to applaud at the start of a speech. That way, if it really fell on its face and turned into a monstrously bad presentation, you're not obligated to applaud at the end because you have already applauded. Dr. DeShazo, Dr. Mendelson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for this opportunity, again, to appear before CSIS and offer some thoughts and views related to Colombia. A warning, ladies and gentlemen, I have in the past come here to discuss Colombia-specific issues, kind of a what is happening in Colombia today, what is its impact on the United States of America and our bilateral relationship, and what directions are we going in. That has been our traditional dialogue and our traditional message, I would argue, over the last 10 years or so, that we have been working together with the government of Colombia on what we euphemistically still refer to as Plan Colombia. And that generally generates a discussion on issues such as drugs, security, human rights, labor violence and labor rights, development, trade, and a fairly long list of bilateral issues. While that is useful, and I personally suggest it has produced a better policy, a better strategy, and a better plan, that's not what I propose to talk to you about today. Today, to a certain extent, I am offering a message for members of this government and Washington-based people, whether NGOs, international organizations, other embassies, whatever they may be, of lessons we may have learned over the last 10 years in Colombia that could be applicable to other countries, other regions, other crises elsewhere in the world, whether they might be named countries that end with the sound Stan, or countries that end in the letter Q, or even large countries in our own hemisphere located immediately below the state of Texas and just above Central America. I take no position on where some of these lessons might be applicable, but I do suggest to you that we have been at this collectively and bilaterally with the government of Colombia for the past 10 years, and it might be a good idea to pause and ask ourselves, have we learned some lessons from this process? Ladies and gentlemen, why me? First, I do not claim to be an expert on all of these other countries outside of Colombia. I do claim to know something about Plan Colombia, something about the decision-making process and something about the programs that we are trying to implement right now. I also suggest that CSIS is a good place to do this because CSIS produced, I think, a very good study that reached exactly these same conclusions and came out about 3 months ago, two of whose three authors are seated to my immediate left. And that was exactly the exercise that they engaged in, which is to say, let's look at what has happened and been done in Colombia for the last 10 years and see if we have learned some lessons there that might be applicable elsewhere. Ladies and gentlemen, I am going to offer you 12 lessons. Why 12? First, there are 12 hours in a traditional clock. Second, there were 12 apostles. And I believe in the NBA you're allowed to have 12 players, albeit only 5 on the court at any given time. But most important, after I got to the 12th lesson, I just ran out of enthusiasm for this project, and I thought 12 was a good place to stop. More on that later. Let me launch. I promise to talk a maximum of maybe 18 minutes. That's a minute and a half per lesson. Lesson learning exercise number one. The year, ladies and gentlemen, is 1999. The United States government, that included me at that time, rallied around a zone that's within 5 miles of where we are sitting right now, decides Colombia is important. What is happening in Colombia is important. We must engage in some way. Many players come to the table within the United States government to argue and discuss this case. We find that there are many priorities. Each department, each agency kind of has their own priority. We see many plans. We see, ladies and gentlemen, a substantial amount of chaos and a difficult question to answer: what should we do? In the summer of 1999, the government of Colombia produced and offered us its own plan, which they chose to call Plan Colombia. I wanted to call it Plan Prosperidad y Progreso, which I thought was more alliterative, but it wasn't my plan. It was the Colombian government's plan. Was the plan perfect? No, of course not. But because it was the plan produced by the government of the nation where we were going to have to develop our own proposals and policies, consensus gelled around the plan. Lesson number one, the host government must drive the strategy. If the host government does not buy in, you do not have a strategy that will work. And that lesson, ladies and gentlemen, I submit is applicable to any country, any crisis, any region, anywhere in the world. And if we choose to engage on the moon or in Mars, I predict it will be applicable there as well. Lesson learning exercise number two. It's now the second half of 1999. We have the plan. It's called Plan Colombia. Then the issue is, right, what will be the United States government's part of this exercise? What will we do? Well, the State Department knows what we will do. So does the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice. USAID knows what we will do. The community whose existence I neither confirm nor deny knows what we will do. The U.S. Southern Command, the U.S. Special Operations Command, the embassy itself in Bogota, they all know what we're going to do. Unfortunately, they are different things, different priorities, different specialties. Too many voices, not enough chiefs driving those voices, confusion that is not only transmitted here in Washington, but quite frankly, is somewhat confusing for the government of Colombia down in Bogota, which is hearing from 15 different agencies and departments and wonders exactly what is the U.S. government's policy. In the early fall of 1999, the then National Security Advisor reaches out to the Under Secretary of State and says, "Would you please run this process?" The Under Secretary's name is Thomas R. Pickering. He takes on the responsibility, and we finally have a process. Everyone accepts that Pickering is the senior guy who is running the process for the entire United States government. Everyone gets a voice, everyone gets a vote, but we now have a system that is run by a specific, identifiable, and accepted person. Lesson number two. Any major crisis response by the United States government requires a senior interagency godfather or godmother. If you do not have that person, you will not deliver a single coherent, comprehensive response. Learning experience number three. Let us move into the years, ladies and gentlemen, 2000-2001. At this stage, your beloved government here in Washington is reaching out to potential allies and partners. We're reaching out to European governments. We're reaching out to the European Union. We're reaching out to some international organizations. We think we are offering them a very attractive proposal. We, the United States government, will do the hard side of this proposal. We'll do the security assistance. We'll do the drug interdiction and eradication. What we're proposing for you, we say, is you do the so-called soft side. You do the economic and social development. You do the humanitarian assistance. You do the stuff that is non-controversial. This seems amazingly logical to us. How could anyone say no to something as simple as that? What we had not factored in were their own institutional timelines, their own bureaucracies, the authorities. They can take money from certain pots for certain purposes, but not for others. The fact that they have their own lead agencies that have to be worked through, the suspicions as to why it was that we were reaching out to them at this point and not at the beginning, were we hiding the ball in some way, shape, or form. Ladies and gentlemen, we thought reaching some accommodation with potential partners would be a matter of months. In fact, it was really a number of years before we had reached a situation where we were more or less working in sync. Lesson number three. Understand your allies' realities, political, bureaucratic, legal. If you do not, you will not have allies. They operate under their own realities just as do we. There is a caveat to this lesson, by the way, which the CSIS report does note, and that is, actually, if you do have the resources to go it alone, it's cleaner and in many ways easier not to try to operate a large coalition. But that's a big if. That was not our intention at the start of this process, and while at the end it may have simplified the process, it certainly did not simplify the initial months and years of our support for Plan Colombia. Learning process number four. By the year 2000, we had a plan. The plan actually was focused initially on drugs, drug control, drug reduction, drug eradication. Why? Obviously, drugs were part of the package of issues that we were dealing with in the early 2000s. But the real simple reason as to why we focused so overwhelmingly on the drug question in the year 2000 is that that was necessary to build a coalition in the United States Congress to get them to vote a big blob of money in the first supplemental appropriation that came out to support Plan Colombia. What happened? Realities changed. Realities changed on the 11th of September 2001, where drugs, while still important, became perhaps slightly less important than the question of terrorism. and we had to adjust our approach, our focus. As President Uribe came to office in 2002, his policy was the so-called democratic security policy. That involved adjustments to our plan. 2 years later, we found the AUC demobilization effort that took a large number of armed irregular forces out of the field, at least in a military organization, and produced or required adjustments in our plan. Some of you may recall there was a U.S. national election in November of 2006, which changed the majorities of both houses of Congress. And another election, you may vaguely recall, in November of 2008, which changed the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Each one of these changes required adjustments and adaptations to the original plan, the original strategy. Lesson number four, your plan must be adaptable, both in Washington and in the field. Facts on the ground will change. The facts when you start an exercise and the facts 10 years later, which is where we are right now, will change regardless of where you are, what you are doing, or who you are doing it with. Let me stay in the year 2001 because that is the starting point for this little learning exercise. As the year developed, we found ourselves welcoming the many, many visitors from the General Accounting Office of the United States Congress, from the Inspector General's Office of the Departments of State and Defense and USAID, from the media and their heightened focus and attention on Colombia as the decade developed, and from many, many NGOs who had understandable, legitimate, and proper interest in what was happening in Colombia and what we were doing to support programs and policies. They assessed our goals. They assessed our metrics. They assessed our success in terms of accomplishing the goals that we ourselves offered up to them. For example, some idiot deputy assistant secretary in the year 2000 said, with any luck, we might see a reduction of 50% of coca cultivation in Colombia in about 5 years' time. That was a stupid, stupid thing for him to have said, although in his defense, then Assistant Secretary Randy Beers was saying exactly the same thing. But this is a classic example of what your assessors and your validators are going to be doing. You establish the milestones. The milestones are important, but you should not lose sight of the larger picture as you try to cross your milestones, which leads me to lesson number five. Don't resist them, comma, work with your assessors and your validators on goals and metrics, but keep the trend line in mind. It is the trend line that will eventually tell you if your program, if your plan, if your policy has been successful. The next learning exercise takes you to about the year 2002. The United States government and the government of Colombia launched Plan Colombia with great zest, enthusiasm, and fanfare. And obviously, governments wanted to see results, and they wanted to see them fast. No one wants to be told that we're making a major investment right now, and I remind you, the original Plan Colombia appropriation bill was for slightly more than $1 billion, and the members of Congress who voted for this bill did not want to be told that in 10 years they might see some impact. What they wanted to be told was, we're voting it now in June. What are we going to see by December of this year? So we launched in a number of areas. The most obvious, for the lesson I'm attempting to learn, was down in the south near the Ecuadorian border in Putumayo. And we cranked out some development programs, Heart of Palms, if I recall correctly, maybe threw in a few more palm plantations as well, created a couple of canning plants, and it was very visible. This was cool stuff. I mean, I was down there by the middle to end of 2001, and there was stuff you could see and you could visit. And anyone who wanted to say, what's happened to our money, could go down there and see the results 6 months after they had voted the bill. What do you see now if you go there? Almost nothing, because these programs, which were designed to be quick starters and to deliver very early and rapid results, did not have staying power for a number of reasons. Partly because they were focused perhaps on the wrong agricultural products, partly because they were in the wrong places, partly because the infrastructure that had to support them in order to make them permanent was not there. By the year 2003, we'd begun to catch on, and we realized that in order for programs to be permanent, you had to integrate, as General Petraeus would say, both clear, hold, and build. You had to integrate a security element with a holding element, which in essence means permanent state police, which means law enforcement, which means police, with the civilian institutions that can run basic civilian programs. When you're able to integrate those three elements, your programs will stick and they have staying power. Lesson number six. Spray eradication and emergency development programs are not a substitute for permanent state presence. Without security and state institutions on the ground, your strategy will not work. And ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that we learned that lesson the hard way in Colombia. And those of you who do not believe me, feel free to visit the Department of Putumayo at your leisure and take a look at some of these 2000 and 2001 programs. Next learning exercise, roughly the same time frame, first half of this decade. Ladies and gentlemen, throughout the Plan Colombia process, but certainly in the early years, 1999, 2000 to 2002, we were dealing with a peace process. The peace process produced a DMZ called a despeje, and an eventually fruitless effort to try to integrate the FARC and the ELN into some sort of peace negotiation. It was a mess, and it produced, at the end of the day, no result in terms of the desired outcome of peace. 5 years later, we entered into the AUC demobilization effort. Say what you will about the process, it did take down an organization in a military sense, as a national military organization. It also involved a lot of compromises. It involved people having to accept that some accountability for past actions would be sacrificed. It received a substantial amount of criticism for being sloppy, for leaving behind criminal organizations and criminal bands. Although my argument would be, at the end of the day, it produced a better situation than at the start, which allows me to draw the following lesson number seven. Demobilizing armed organizations is inherently messy, unfair, and requiring great compromises. Prepare for it. I do not care whether you are trying to demobilize armed organizations in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Mexico. There has never, to the best of my knowledge, in the history of the world, been a completely clean, pristine, logical, non-sloppy demobilization of a large armed organization. If you require that degree of precision and cleanliness, accept that you are probably not going to demobilize the organization. Argue about the terms, argue about the timeline, argue about how you're going to accomplish this, but do not set the expectation that you can do it in a way that is not going to require serious compromises and a serious amount of non-accountability for many of those who will demobilize. Learning process number 8. Ladies and gentlemen, our part of Plan Colombia was very much the hard side. That's counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism, used as a euphemism here for the security package and COIN, as we sometimes say on the counter-insurgency front. The focus, logically and inevitably for such programs, are the armed and security forces. If you're talking about security programs and drug programs, at least initially, that's where you're going to focus your effort. Now, a fairly large community was monitoring this effort on our part in the early years of the 2000s, and I might add, continuing to this day. We call that community the human rights community. They properly were holding us accountable as we worked with these institutions and organizations, the armed and security forces, who had been, in the past, major players in accusations and allegations of human rights abuses. They were holding us accountable for what our programs were doing, who they were working with, and what they were requiring from these institutions in order to receive our backing, support, and assistance. They properly insisted upon very rigorous accountability and indicators of progress in the course of the years 2000 to 2009. Just to make sure we got the message, they went to the United States Congress and had a good bit of text and language written into the laws and report language that actually directed us quite specifically to incorporate these concerns into our programs. Ladies and gentlemen, may I say, right now for the record, they were absolutely right. While you can argue about where you draw the line between a negative approach and a positive approach, you cannot deny that you must incorporate human rights and civil and political rights into your programs. And in our case, we actually incorporated into our programs an administration of justice program managed largely by the Department of Justice that was explicitly designed to address this issue. Which leads me to the rather obvious lesson number 8. You must, I repeat, must integrate human rights, humanitarian, labor, and democratic institutions into your strategy. If you do not do it on your own, Congress will do it for you, or, alternatively, you will fail. Your strategy will not work. Learning exercise number 9. By the year 2005, it was clear that what I would call our standalone programs were not working exceptionally well. That is to say, we would parachute into a region or a community and crank up a program designed to address a threat or a problem in that region or community. What we were beginning to learn by about the year 2005 was that we had to build the institutions. It was not enough to go down and build a clinic, build a school, or even lay in 10 miles of highway in a specific region or a specific community. If we did not build the institutions that were to serve as, if you will, the foundation for the programs in that community, the programs would not work. Now, this is tricky for a couple of reasons. First, it's a lot easier to deliver helicopters, boats, and equipment as opposed to delivering long-term programs to support and strengthen institutions. Second, Washington likes to see quick, visible results to programs, and long-term institution building doesn't deliver that sort of early gratification. Helicopters, boats, and equipment do. Institution building is long-term. It requires patience, and you will take a lot of heat for non-delivery of results before those results are evident. That said, lesson number 9, long-term success requires a focus on building institutions. In short, you've got to take the criticism. You've got to take the heat. If you don't, in 5 years' time, rather than arguing about why they can't see the results from your program, what they will be asking you is, why have these programs failed? And that, I submit, is a more difficult question to respond to than the question of why is it taking so long. Learning exercise number 10. We were guilty in the early years of our support for Columbia and Plan Columbia of focusing almost exclusively on the Columbia set of problems as an internal Columbia issue. Now, it was logical. We were dealing with crime and narcotics trafficking in Columbia. We were dealing with terrorism from Colombia. We were dealing with a security situation in Colombia. We were dealing with the Colombian national economy. And it was perfectly logical, I suppose, in the year 2000, 2001, 2002, to think of this project as a Colombia-only project supported by the United States of America. What we perhaps should have done in the early stages was to take a step back and ponder how this effort, this partnership, would be perceived elsewhere in the region. Would it be perceived by a neighbor or two as the harbinger of the long-expected invasion that is threatened almost daily by the leader of that particular nation? Would it be perceived by a very large country located in the middle of South America that has borders with every country, I believe, in South America, with the exception of Ecuador and Chile, as a growing U.S. presence in the region, as they are attempting to assert greater influence as a regional player? Might it be seen by some neighbors as a program whose impact would be eventually to push the FARC, or to push narcotics traffickers from Colombia into other countries? Might it even be seen as a program whose inevitable effect will be to return coca cultivation and cocaine production to countries who had successfully moved most of that out in the 1990s? Ladies and gentlemen, I don't say that any of these unnamed countries were right in their criticism or even right in their concerns, but I do say that perceptions matter. And it is important as you develop a crisis response to a set of crises, even if they are focused on one specific country, to remember that it is going to have an impact, even if the impact is simply one of perception, in other countries in the region. Therefore, my lesson number 10 is, remember that your strategy will have an impact on other neighbors in the region, intended or not. Plan for it. If you do not plan for it, you will be reacting to it without a plan. I only have two more, but these are good ones. First, because we're closing out, there's been a chronological pitch to this to some extent. My next process starts somewhere around the year 2007. So we're getting very close to real time now, ladies and gentlemen. And we are confronting the following reality. Funding to support Plan Colombia-related programs is going down. The United States Congress, and in a larger sense, the United States government's patience level, rarely extends for more than 3 or 4 years before pressure begins to build to drive the numbers down. Why are we funding so much of this? Why are we called upon to do this appropriation yet once again? It is inevitable. It's going to happen. And the truth is, you're going to enter a transition phase. Transition from plussing up to leveling off to going down. Transitions are always difficult. I have never lived through a transition that did not produce some degree of difficulty caused by that simple human emotion of being more comfortable with things that you know rather than things that are changing and that by definition you do not know so well. In Colombia and in our programs of support for Colombia, we have tried to manage the transition through concepts such as nationalization, whereby we withdraw from support for certain programs and the Colombian government assumes the support and responsibility for those programs. And more recently, what we call the Colombia Strategic Development Initiative, or CSDI, which is an attempt to identify specific regions where we will concentrate our efforts in the expectation that we will reduce the priority in other parts of the country and gradually wind down programs as we solve the security, drug, and developmental challenges in the defined zones. Whether you call it an end game or you call it an exit strategy, the result is the same, and that is transitioning from initial crisis response to gradual reduction of support and participation. My lesson is number 11. Whatever the location, whatever the plan, it is not infinite. Plan for your end game, make it adaptable, incorporate the host government in your end game planning. If you do not, you are simply reacting, and this basically means you're backing into your end game without even realizing where you are headed. Final lesson, number 12. Throughout the past 10 years, which is roughly the amount of time we have been engaged in supporting Colombia under Plan Colombia. I would remind you that the original proposed appropriations bill, the first one, went to the United States Congress in January of 2000. That's almost exactly 10 years ago. There have been a lot of public comments and public commentary over Plan Colombia and support for Plan Colombia over the last 10 years. There have been a lot of mixed public signals, which is logical, proper, and correct when hundreds, if not thousands, of people are engaging in a very complicated strategy and expressing their views as to what it should do and what their role in it should be. We have seen all sorts of signals on drugs, security, terrorism, human rights, labor rights, trade, neighbors in the region, and several dozen, if not hundreds, of other issues as well. Some of those signals have crossed. Sometimes certain things have been said 1 year, and different things are said in following years. I submit, ladies and gentlemen, it is inevitable that the public message is going to change in the course of a long-term program. It's going to change because the facts on the ground change. It is going to change because governments change, both in the field, in this case Colombia, or up here in Washington. It is going to change because people lose patience. It is going to change because people have different priorities as the years go by. One thing that should not change is basically trying to be as transparent and honest as possible in your public message. Because if you are not, the people will figure it out. For the most part, and particularly when they are in large collective groups, people are not stupid. Get them individually, and I can identify plenty of dumbbells, but if you're talking about an entire nation or community, they're not stupid. And if you can't explain publicly what you are doing and what you are trying to accomplish, you probably do not have a very good policy, which is a good fundamental rule. Lesson number 12. Be honest in public, perhaps not giving all of the sensitive detail that you are working, but remember the basic rule. If you can't explain publicly what you are doing, you probably don't have a very good plan. And that, ladies and gentlemen, ends my 12 lessons. There are probably 12,000 more lessons out there. I bet every one of you could offer up another 12 lessons better than the 12 that I have offered you, which allows me, I suppose, to offer you, in closing, the most important lesson of all, lesson number 13. Anyone who tries to summarize lessons learned from Plan Colombia in only 12 lessons doesn't have a clue what he is talking about. Thank you very much, and over to you. Shall I sit or shall I stand?
Why don't you stand?
Oh, you rascal, you.
Spotlight. Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for your comments. I'd like to extend a very cordial welcome to Her Excellency Carolina Barco, Ambassador of Colombia, who's joined us, and to her colleagues from the embassy. Welcome to you all. We'll now move to what I'm sure you're all looking forward to, asking some really difficult questions to Ambassador Brownfield, who will give you some really honest answers.
Because that's lesson 12.
No, I was going to ask you if it was the 12 days of Christmas you were trying to give us.
That's a good point, exactly.
You see, I thought
12 players allowed to be on an NBA roster.
Right, but it was the 13th where I got worried, especially there. But the floor is open for questions, comments. Okay. The back, there was a lady in hand in the middle in the back. Do we have a microphone?
Yes, we do have a microphone. We should have a microphone. We are told we have a microphone.
Okay. Well, if not, talk loudly.
Speak loudly.
I can hear fine, but then again, I can't speak loudly.
I'll be loud. I'm Maria with FM News Services, and thank you for taking my question. It's a little bit unrelated to Plan Colombia, but here it goes. The Washington Post recently had an editorial saying that President Uribe should not seek the re-election because it will damage democracy and his legacy in general. And the Obama administration has sort of hinted at that as well. So, from your vantage point, what do you
I wondered how long it would take before my lessons learned exercise would move off of that theme and into Columbia specific. And the answer is no time whatsoever. Perfectly fair question. First, let me open by saying on this issue, there are quite clearly two very important democratic principles at play. One democratic principle, which I assume everyone in this room agrees with, is non-permanence in power. It is almost impossible. I guess you can have a monarch who is more titular than real, but permanence in power is inherently inconsistent with the principle of democracy. So that's a fairly important principle, non-permanence in power. A second principle, which is kind of important as well, is the right of the people to select who they want for their own government. And I would argue that that also is a fairly important principle in any democratic institution. To a very considerable extent, what is happening in Colombia today is a great national debate, and it is a debate. And there are very few people in Colombia today who do not have an opinion on this issue and who have not expressed an opinion on this issue. And the debate is between those two principles. Now, does the United States government have a position on this? I will cite almost word for word the comments of President Barack Obama on the morning of the 29th of June, 2009, in a room not more than perhaps a mile from where we are sitting right now, when asked a very similar question. And he said, first, this is a matter for the Colombian people to decide for themselves. Second, he said, here in the United States, we find that we're usually ready for a change after about 8 years in office. And then he paused, and then he looked back over the mantle where there was a portrait of George Washington, and he said, you know, one of the reasons why we regard George Washington as a great president is that after two terms, when he could clearly have served as president for the rest of his life, he decided to leave office and turn the presidency over to his successor. And ladies and gentlemen, I think I will leave my answer with just those words from President Obama. No ambassador ever went far wrong by quoting the President of the United States.
Well, now that you've gotten that off your chest, we can take a few other questions. Lady right here in the middle. Is there a microphone? Yes, yeah, it's coming to you. You'll wait a minute. Oh, no, there was, I was actually pointing to someone too.
Well, you're pretty.
In front, but go ahead.
You're ahead. You're pretty
there.
Strict in terms
Thank
of that microphone.
I am.
I want you to, I'll take a question from anyone.
Thank you.
That's a nasty question, in which case I have to leave.
Well, actually, thank you very much. My name is Silvia Yusa from the German Press Agency. As you were talking about lessons and with Colombia, there have been, with the decision of the United States of disagreement with for the use of military base has sparked again questioning about the interventionism of the USA. And what right now we're about to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Panama that also has been used
and
as an example.
And the fall of the Berlin Wall, by the way.
So now I wanted to ask you if there is a lesson learned from the U.S. because the strategy has changed, but the accusations are always the same about interventionism in Latin America. Thank you.
Yep. This could conceivably be a lesson learned, by the way, which had I stretched my list out and bored you all for countless hours instead of just 25 or 30 minutes, I might have found a way to roll this into the lesson learned. First, the direct response to your question, the Defense Cooperation Agreement is, as the President of the United States said a couple of months ago, in essence a modernization of existing agreements. There are existing defense agreements between the United States and Colombia that date to 1952, 1962, and 1974. Under those agreements, we have been able to do all of the cooperative missions and engagement under Plan Colombia for the last 10 years. We've done them with an occasional exchange of diplomatic notes or a gentleman's agreement or phone calls to sort through issues. But basically, those three agreements were sufficient to allow us to do everything that we have done for the last 10 years in a legal and administrative manner. The question, in essence, was whether it would be a good idea to have an agreement that actually reflects the realities of the 21st century, cooperation on drugs, cooperation against terrorism, as opposed to the realities of 1952, when Harry Truman was the president of the United States and Joseph Stalin was the leader of the Soviet Union. And the agreement was designed to envision a conflict of a Cold War nature. And the argument was a more modern agreement that reflects those realities is a better thing than a jury-rigged agreement from 57 years ago. I still agree with that conclusion and that assessment, although, obviously, nothing is ever done perfectly, and I am certain that there are people who will say correctly that there are things we could have done better in terms of how the agreement was negotiated, how it was rolled out and presented. That said, I do want to be clear on a couple of points. One, the agreement is not new. It is a reorganization of existing agreements. Second, the agreement does not deal with any new cooperation activities or missions. They will be exactly, precisely the same missions after the signing of the agreement as they were before. You could stand in front, park, camp out in front of each of the seven named bases with a checklist assessing everything that was happening, say, the year before the agreement was signed and the year after, and you will find no difference whatsoever. And third, the agreement does not call for, nor should you expect, any increase in U.S. military personnel in Colombia. On the contrary, you should probably expect a decrease. And the reason is very simple. The budget is going down. Congress is reducing the security assistance, funding, and resources for Colombia. As that is reduced, the military that support and manage those programs will reduce as well. Early in the year 2007, some 7 or 8 months before I got to post, we hit the high point in terms of number of U.S. military personnel in country at one time. And it was about 570, I think, somewhere around there. The number now is about 250. Of that 250, slightly more than half are actually inside the embassy. They work in offices in the embassy. That number is going to continue to go down. It would not surprise me at all. I am not saying it's going to happen, but it would not surprise me at all that by this time next year, we're going to find that it's down around 200. That's what is going to happen because Congress has determined that the security assistance budget will go down. Now, will we continue to hear about this issue? Unquestionably, we will. Some governments, some leaders believe it is in either their political interest or their national interest to focus on this issue. They have a right to do so. I do not challenge their right. I do, however, challenge the right of anyone to change the facts. And the facts are what I've just laid out.
A question in the back and one over here in the middle. Do you want to take a group at a time or do you want to?
I can do groups. I can do individual. I'm comfy.
Okay.
I sometimes can't remember too much at the same time.
Right, well,
so stop them after two or three.
Let's take.
Ambassador. Here.
Somebody got a microphone. Yeah.
Hi. Okay. Ambassador, my name is Juan Carlos Iragorri. I'm the U.S. correspondent of Semana, the Colombian magazine. I'm sure you're.
Delivery has been postponed. I've got it not until Sunday.
Okay. I will tell them. I will tell them. I have two questions. The first one is it true, as the Economist said, that the government of Colombia insisted more than the government of the U.S. in closing this agreement regarding the military bases? And the second question, of course, your answer will be no. Are you negotiating any secret agreement with Colombia parallel to the one of the bases?
Look, these are actually simple questions, so let me knock these ones off right away. By the way, the answer to both questions is no and no. But let me illuminate on both. First, what the Economist reported was that it was the government of Colombia who was pushing this defense cooperation agreement, implying, in fact, that it was the government of Colombia's idea. Not so, ladies and gentlemen. Let me be very clear on this. The United States government proposed in the second half of the year 2008 some sort of defense cooperation agreement with the government of Colombia. Are you with me? U.S. government proposed to the Colombian government. Now, we eventually entered into formal negotiations. They started in March, I believe, of this year and concluded in July. What was the motivation of the two governments? Obviously, the two governments must speak for themselves. Our motivation was to have a modern agreement that reflected the realities of the 21st century and our actual cooperation rather than a jury-rigged agreement from 1952. That's why we wanted a defense cooperation agreement. I obviously cannot speak for the motivation of the government of Colombia. They are quite capable of speaking for themselves. But this was not an idea of the government of Colombia, and this was not a negotiation that would have concluded were they not pushing us. This was a joint negotiated process, and that, I submit, is a matter of historical fact. Second question is, it's even simpler. The answer is no. There is no secret agreement being negotiated. Or I suppose I could say, if it is, I'm unaware of it. And I am fairly certain that nothing happens in my embassy without my knowing something about it. So I am uncharacteristically prepared to say categorically, no. There is no secret agreement being negotiated related to this issue or, to the best of my knowledge, any other issue right now in the bilateral relationship.
There is a lady who's been very patient. Could we get it in the middle row center, please?
I'm ready. I don't insist. They're pretty strict.
I do because my voice is not very strong. Gotcha. Two related questions. The first one is, why was the announcement of the Manta basis not detailed in the Colombian press or in the U.S. press? Yet it seemed that our neighbors to the east claimed to know more about what that agreement contained than the Colombian public. And as you said, one of your lessons is that the public be told what is happening on both sides, both the U.S. and the Colombians.
Okay.
And then the second question that I have is, as we all know, Venezuela has moved troops to the border with Colombia. And this all started right after the issue of the military bases. And what is the likely response of the U.S. going to be with regard to the movement of those troops, if any?
Okay.
Did everyone...
In fact, I had to clarify on the first question. When you say the Manta bases, announcement of the Manta bases, you're talking about the U.S.-Colombia Defense Cooperation Agreement, right? Because I believe the closure of the conclusion of the agreement related to Manta and Ecuador was widely announced more than a year ahead of time, and that was obviously an Ecuadorian issue on which obviously I'm not in a position to offer a view or a position. Look, the agreement itself, while I accept and to a certain extent feel well battered with criticism on this issue, I do not believe this agreement was done in any particularly secretive manner. I began talking about it in public in April. It might even have been March, but it was certainly no later than April. And in public, I mean, I was talking to the media. This was not an attempt to conceal anything. And I'm fairly certain, I recall at least one time, standing right next to the then defense minister, who was talking about it in public as well. The old saying, I guess, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. We can emit messages in public. I guess we can't make people listen if they are not inclined to listen to us. I do not believe this was a secret agreement. I do not believe ever in the history of the human race, and I hope I've given you plenty of space to criticize me if you think I'm wrong. I don't believe ever in the history of the human race has an agreement actually been kind of a bilateral agreement, been negotiated in public, you know, kind of sit in the middle of a football stadium with 80,000 people there listening to you as you're arguing about whether we should have a comma here or change this particular paragraph. I think virtually every agreement, and I just said every agreement that's ever been negotiated, you negotiate it between the parties, and then, in most cases, the agreement is then made available publicly, which is what happened in this instance as well. You ask, why did it appear that the gentleman and the government in the country to the east seemed to have access to this agreement earlier? I'm not sure that they did. I believe they expressed strong views, but I don't think they had any greater access to the agreement than anyone else did until it was published about whenever it was, I guess, about a couple of weeks after we had reached the final text, which was a translation issue among other issues. And again, I repeat, it is possible that other governments and other leaders have either political assessments or assessments of their national interests that's going to lead them to say certain things. I can't do much about that. No one can. I do believe we owe transparency, and the agreement is now available to anyone on the planet who has access to the Internet. The agreement was formally passed, not submitted for ratification, but transmitted to both the United States Congress and the National Congress of Colombia, despite the fact that under Colombia's law, as I understand it, since this was treated as an amendment to an existing agreement, congressional notification was not required. In our case, it is under the procedures established some decades ago for concluding an executive agreement. You asked the question, and you finally gave it a U.S. A component, because normally I wouldn't touch the issue, but that is a U.S. response to threats to move forces to the border between Venezuela and Colombia. I'm going to have to hide to a certain extent behind the public statements that we have already made on this issue. And we have acknowledged and applauded the government of Colombia for its serious, moderate, and prudent response to various public declarations, threats, and suggestions. We have called upon both governments to try to find a way to resolve this issue. We have acknowledged that the government of Colombia has, in fact, expressed its willingness to work with other international organizations or with other mediators to bring this to conclusion, and we have applauded that. We have expressly refrained from taking any position on what the other government might be doing. And I submit to you, and this is a purely hypothetical situation that has nothing to do with any reality whatsoever, but let's assume we have the following hypothetical situation. Two neighbors are squabbling on the block. One of those two is desperately trying to suck a third neighbor into the argument so he can blame him for everything that's going wrong. What does that third neighbor want to do at that moment? Does he wish to, in essence, walk right into the situation that the neighbor number one is trying to provoke? Or does he try to be helpful without getting sucked in to the direct argument? That is a hypothetical situation. That has nothing to do with any current real-world situation. It is merely a thought that came to me as I was standing here at the podium.
Okay, Steve, did you have a question? Microphone in the back.
He can shout. He's got a big voice.
We know
that. And a handsome Christmas sweater on as well. And look, it's a green tie.
The microphone's here.
Stephen Donahue from McLarty Associates. Not really, but I'll do my best. What you've outlined, it seems to me, provides a great way to provide a framework for Washington, as you said at the beginning, for policymakers and for people that are thinking about the theoretical constructs for dealing with these kind of conflicts. Are there lessons at a more tactical level that the U.S. entities involved in this project and that Colombian entities involved in this have learned that might be useful for sharing with the countries that you outlined at the beginning? And is Colombia, without declaring victory, in a position to be helpful to those other countries in providing those lessons learned?
Yeah. That's actually a very good question. To a certain extent, it puts me a bit on the spot in this large public on the record setting. The answer, I think, is yes. And I believe it is in everyone's interest. Other crisis countries, United States of America, Colombia, that in fact we see, where possible, some direct engagement. Because I do believe there are some serious lessons learned. Countries that are confronting a narcotics production and narcotics trafficking crisis are fools not to draw upon some of the tactical lessons learned principally by the Colombian National Police, to a certain extent by other elements of the Colombian Armed Forces, and quite frankly, the Colombian Attorney General or Prosecutor General's office. They have learned some serious lessons. They have learned lessons about eradication, what works and what doesn't. They have learned lessons about interdiction and how you must do interdiction operations in a hostile setting. They have learned lessons about how to prosecute large, powerful, violent organizations. They have learned lessons about how to dismantle those organizations. And they continue to learn lessons from how to dismantle large national cartels, which in essence was the lessons that were learned in the 1990s, to the current decade, where the lessons being learned of a tactical nature are how to attack and dismantle much smaller organizations with the atomization, if you will, of narcotics trafficking organizations. These actually are very important lessons, and many of these are in fact transferable, whether you're transferring them to a place like Afghanistan or transferring them to Mexico. Now note, I am not suggesting every lesson learned in Colombia is applicable in different societies, different cultures, different languages, different histories, different regions, different topographies, that obviously there will be variations and some lessons that just don't apply. But there's all sorts. There's oodles of tactical lessons that are out there. I would submit that the tactical approach of the Colombian armed and police forces today in terms of their jointness is infinitely more sophisticated than it was 10 years ago, really even 5 years ago. I would submit to you that the ability now of the Colombian National Police to work in tandem with investigators and prosecutors so that they're actually able to work systematically to do the paramilitary operation, that's take on a heavily armed and fairly populous organization in a strike operation, through the investigatory function, and that is have people that are literally right behind you that are collecting evidence that can be used in a court of law, to the prosecutorial function, and that is the blipping prosecutor who might literally be in the next helicopter behind you, who basically is trying to assess what does he need to build a case. Is he saying, you got to find me some of the product here, so I've got it to present in court? Or is he saying, if we can find weapons here, we can make a case for, that's a higher level. This is a lesson learned. This is something that they were not doing 20 years ago when it was completely separate and devoid. And after the military-type operation, 3 weeks later, an investigator arrives and he says, wow, there's no evidence here. I can't make a case. There's nothing here but a hole in the ground. That is the sort of thing that I submit is tactical in nature and can, in fact, be delivered. And finally, I'm on a soapbox now, and I will stop. I do believe there is great value in direct cross-communication. I believe there is great value, particularly in Colombian law enforcement and prosecution personnel, dealing directly with, for example, Mexican law enforcement and prosecutorial personnel. They speak the same language. They come from the same region. They are frequently dealing with exactly the same organization, just in a different phase in terms of their line of movement from the south to the north or from the south to the east and Western Europe. But I could even make the case for Afghanistan as well. And in fact, there have been some CNP training missions that have gone to Afghanistan. Trickier there. We're dealing, obviously, with a different culture, different language, different religion, different history, and even a different product. I mean, I think the Colombian principal expertise right now is attacking the cocaine threat, whereas obviously the threat that is affecting Afghanistan right now is heroin. And they are sufficiently different in a tactical sense that you do have to figure, a slightly different set of lessons. But you can't tell me that some of these fundamental lessons don't apply there as well. The answer, simply stated, is yes.
Okay. Tim, the gentleman next to the camera on the pink there, please.
Right. Ambassador Brownfield, Sergio Gomez, Washington correspondent of El Tiempo. How are you doing?
Yeah, you're Matt. Yours is coming more or less on time. Sometimes I get up by 5:30, though. It hasn't arrived.
Ambassador, recently the Colombia government announced that there was a reduction in the amount of manual eradicated hectares of coca in Colombia. Now that you were talking about the exit strategy and the funds being reduced, and now that for the first time in years there's a percentage of hectares of 30% reduction, doesn't it seem strange, or how concerned are you that might affect the results that you were aiming for at the beginning?
Yep. Remember, perfectly fair question, but remember, hang on, I got to get my numbers right. Remember lesson four, your plan must be adaptable. Remember lesson six, spray operations and development are not a substitute for state presence. Yeah, it covers it. And lesson number nine, long-term success does require institution building and not just your specific programs. Look, as El Tiempo and other media in Colombia correctly reported last week, this was a two-part story. One part was that the United States government, and specifically the Crime and Narcotics Center, had briefed President Uribe on the results of the preceding year. And those results indicated a reduction in total coca cultivation of 29%, which I rounded up to 30, and a reduction in total cocaine production of 39%, which I rounded up to 40. I thought this was good news, not because I believe we should be wedded to the figures, because the numbers are going to go up and the numbers are going to go down, but because it is a positive trend line And, to be honest with you, because I was beaten over the head so much for the preceding 5 or 6 years that the numbers weren't going down, it was somewhat satisfying for me to say to all those critics who had been pissing on me for the preceding 5 years because the numbers weren't going down, to finally say to them, well, they went down this year, so what do you think about that? And, of course, what they think is absolute dead silence. But that's okay. But please don't get me wrong. I do not mean but to suggest that with these numbers we can declare success. On the contrary, as President Uribe himself stated later on, we do have to address the issue of a reduction in manual eradication. I might add, from our side, we're also addressing the issue of a reduction in aerial eradication. We have dropped from a high of around, I don't recall what the high was, I think, and I don't see anyone here that would necessarily help me out here, but I believe we tapped out at about 150,000 hectares, and we're down now to about 100,000 hectares of aerial eradication. And manual eradication has dropped as well. What's dropping it? It's budget. It is how much money, how many resources the two governments are prepared to put into this program. Is it a problem? It is a problem only if the narcotics trafficking organizations see this as an opportunity, a vacuum that they can fill. To a certain extent, what we are having to determine is whether the progress on narcotics has advanced so far that these organizations have decided to conduct their operations elsewhere, wherever that might be, and they will not return to Colombia because it is too expensive for them to do their business in Colombia. Are we at that point? I don't know. I submit to you that next year we will have a clearer sense. What we saw this year was a dramatic drop in the basic numbers. Added to that, I would add, by the way, is the fact that DEA's domestic surveys indicate that the price of cocaine on the streets of the United States have risen sharply, and the purity of cocaine that is purchased on the streets of the United States have dropped dramatically. And those statistics are consistent with a pattern of less cocaine coming into the United States of America, which in turn is consistent with a substantial drop in cultivation and production in Colombia. Is it permanent? We'll see. My own view would be let's focus on what the trend line is saying and where the areas are that we need to concentrate our efforts. That's what the numbers do for me. The numbers don't tell me whether we have been successful or unsuccessful. The numbers tell me we should concentrate more here and less there. The numbers tell me we should be looking in other countries, because if the numbers are going down in Colombia, they're probably growing somewhere else. And the numbers tell me that we should focus on issues other than simple eradication and interdiction, as the director of ONDCP himself has suggested in recent weeks. That's what it says to me. We'll find out what the final answer is in the months and years ahead. Don't look at me. I can't call on you. Only she can call on you.
Now, there were three people with hands up. There was a gentleman in the front row, I think Diana Negroponte, and Norman, did you have a question? Okay. I'd like to take those questions, and I think we'll have to give you a break.
Thank the Lord. I'm exhausted. I may collapse.
Take another glass of water. Yes, sir? Yes, sir.
Mr. Ambassador, first off, let me thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. My name is Jim Jones, and I've been involved.
Thank you. My name is Jim Jones, and I've been involved sporadically, sometimes deeply, in Colombia since 1969, and was a former UN anti-drugs advisor. One hears it said quite often here in Washington that Colombia is a democracy, South America's oldest democracy, I hear sometimes. And I have to reflect on that a little bit. And here you have a country that's had something like 13 insurgent movements over the past 50 years. Five or six of those have been substantial. Two of them are very much alive today and very active. In addition to that, we have a country with the so-called false positives, the killing of civilians by the military and passing them off as insurgents killed in combat. We have a major scandal on the part of the secret police, the DAS, of intervening in communications of Colombians across the board. And I could go on and on and on and on. So, and taking up on what the lady here said earlier about the bases agreement, I hear you what you said on that, and I believe you. In Colombia, that is seen as something that was done behind the backs of the Colombian people, and that's the way they see it. I mean, I'm in touch with a few people at a fairly high level in Colombia. So thinking about all of this, then my question to you is, in what sense is it a democracy? Thank you.
Sure. I mean, no, let me knock this one off while we're here on the issue, because it's potentially emotive. And here's my response. I come from a country which, in its first 150 years, permitted slavery of one human being over another. It's a country that divided itself in half and fought a war in which a million people died. I come from a country which 35 years ago, the president of that country apparently misused and distorted both a large law enforcement institution, the FBI, and an intelligence organization, the CIA. I come from a country in which people routinely and daily savage and pillory the Supreme Court, judges, federal judges, the United States Congress. I come from a country in which members of its national legislature every single year are prosecuted for crimes and irregularities. And I regard that country as a democracy. It is not a perfect democracy. It is not a democracy that I expect any other country to follow or pursue. And I am absolutely confident that the country that I come from is, in fact, a democracy. I believe exactly the same thing could be said about Colombia. It is a country that has a large number of problems. I would bet you that if there were a survey in which, and I'm not sure how this could be done, but in which the basic question is asked, do you believe Colombia is a democracy? The overwhelming majority, 95% perhaps, would answer that question in some way in the affirmative. You have your view. I have mine. You've just heard it.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Brownfield. I think this brings our session to a close. And again, we appreciate the 12 lessons for the 12 days.
The 13th. Don't forget the 13th.
Well, it's an unlucky number, but we hope that you'll join us again as things move ahead in Colombia. And thank you, everybody, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for your patience.